morning, good evening, good coding campers. It's Monday, and that means it's time for MSDN Radio, the show that helps developers find what they're looking for. Good code, good conversation, but most of all, good time. So here to bring us into the week is our host, Mike Benkovich.
All right. Hey, thank you, Eric, and I want to welcome everyone back to another edition of MSDN Radio. It is May 17th, 2010. We've got 2 weeks before Tech Ed, and we've got a great show lined up for you today. There's lots of stuff going on in the technology industry, trying to keep up with what's possible, what's going on. With this show, we'll try to help you find what you're looking for, and we go out. And one of the neat things about this show is that we've got a Ask the Expert segment where we bring in a guest who you've heard of. You've probably seen them doing presentations, whether live or on demand, where you can download and watch the sessions afterwards. But how do you ask questions? So in today's show, we've got a dial-in phone line, which you're able to participate in the show by going out and registering for the live meeting, which is the actual recording of the show, and then we'll bring you in to be able to ask questions and talk and have some fun with it. Next week, I just want to mention we've got John Durant coming on from the Office team, and we'll be talking about what's going on with Office, and then we're going to take Memorial Day off, no show on that day, and then the week after that, we'll be down in Tech Ed, and then Zane Novolsky is going to come on and do a show for us. So there's lots of things going on. If you want to hear what we've done in the past, you can always download the MSDN Radio. The individual shows are listed at msdnradio.com. There's links to go out and listen to these on Channel 9. There's also a URL link that I've been using called tinyurl.com/MSDN Radio- and then the show number. So this is show number 9. If you want to listen to the previous shows, just go through and put in the numbers, and then you can get out to it. And I also created a RSS feed so you can download the entire series onto your Zune or in your iPod and be able to hear the whole set of things. What's going on in the technology world? What's been RTM since last time we talked? This week we've got we're basically getting our office out into people's hands, being able to work with all of the stuff that's part of that. And there's also the SQL 2008 launch happened last week, the official getting SQL 2008 R2 out to the people. You can go out to msdn.microsoft.com and be able to see where you can download a lot of this stuff. There's some great blog posts and links there. One other site you're going to probably want to go to is sysinternals.com. If you go to sysinternals.com and then press return, you're going to find out that this is actually now part of Microsoft and kind of fits into today's guest. It was Mark Rasinovich, who comes to us from pretty much around the world. He's been and done a lot of different things. He's a operating system expert. He's been doing quite a few things with how Microsoft and how Windows works and understanding all kinds of interesting tidbits. When I go out and do a presentation, there's a number of utilities I use from SysInternals called Zoomit, amongst others. But he's the author, and we can ask him all of our questions. So, welcome, Mark Rasinovich.
Thanks, Mike. It's my pleasure to be here.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good, thanks.
We were talking before the show, and I'd asked you, a lot of questions like, where are you from? How long have you been out in Redmond now?
Close to 4 years. I joined Microsoft in July of 2006, and right at the time the Winternals and SysInternals were acquired, I moved up from Austin, Texas to Redmond.
Have you made the adjustment to the weather and to the whole change in seasons?
Yeah, actually the adjustment to the weather was pretty straightforward for me because I'd lived in Eugene, Oregon back in the mid-90s
for a
couple of years, and the weather there is similar to here, certainly very different than Austin, where the summers get blisteringly hot.
That's the University of Washington?
Yeah, no. here in Seattle, yeah, University of Washington.
So, but down in Eugene, Oregon, it's University of Oregon, right?
Yep, the Ducks.
I've got a cousin who's actually going to school down there. I did a MSDN event down there. It's interesting when you drive along the coast, all those volcanoes that you can see driving north.
Yeah. Cascades.
That makes you realize just what a big world it really is. Well, today's show, we've got the opportunity for people to come in and ask questions and kind of be a part of the conversation. If you do want to participate, just let us know you've got a question by typing it in on the Q&A panel, which is on the from the live meeting. You just go out and type in that you got a question. We'll give you the phone number, and then when you're dialed in, just press *8, and then I know that you've got a question, and then I'll bring you in to talk. But that's how we'll handle that. But before then, I get the chance to kind of chat with you or with Mark here and Racinovic. Now, that's kind of a different name.
Yes, Croatian.
Croatian, because my last name is Benkovic.
Yep, pretty so. So what nationality is your name?
It's Croatian, also kind of from the Zagreb area.
Yep, that's where split area is, where my name's from.
Yeah, we probably have family in common.
Yeah.
But it's a small world. We also kind of grew up about the same time. You did a lot with different kinds of technologies. What was your first computer?
The first, well, the PC or the personal computer that I touched that changed my life, that made me realize that my previous career aspirations to be an aeronautical engineer weren't nearly as interesting as becoming somebody involved in the world of computers with an Apple II, that a friend of mine had, his father had gotten one through the University of Alabama. I lived in Birmingham at the time. He'd brought it, gotten it at home, and I went over, and it's one of the night days I was hanging out over at my friend's house, and he said, oh, take a look at this computer my dad got, and we sat down and started playing on it, and that's when I decided I wanted to do computer stuff. The first computer that I actually owned was a TI-99/4A.
Mm-hmm.
That one was the reason that I owned that one. It was the most affordable at the time.
I think it was about $99 or something like
that. Yeah, it was pretty relatively inexpensive.
Yeah. Well, cheap computers, it seems like technology has, the price of technology has maintained or gone down as it's gotten faster and become more commoditized.
Yeah.
We've got my TechNet peer and friend, Kevin Remby, is also on the phone. He's joining us today from Minneapolis as well. Kevin, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks. I really appreciate you letting me join in the conversation, Mike.
Sure.
And on that same topic of first computers, that Apple II Plus was actually my first computer too. I was extremely excited when I bought the chip that gave me lowercase.
Yeah.
That was a big deal.
Well, it's almost like being able to do copy and paste or on a phone. You just kind of take things for granted. So operating systems, Mark, you've been doing the Sys internals for about 10 years or more.
Yeah, coming on. This is year 4.
So how did you get started doing the Sys internals, and how did that kind of flow out of your academic stuff, or was that more out of work?
It was kind of a mixture. Back in 1996 when we founded Sys internals, I'd just come out from doing a postdoc at the University of Oregon and gone into industry. I joined a company called Numega Technologies in Nashua, New Hampshire. Some of the listeners might remember Numega Technologies for a couple of the products that they developed that were very popular. One, SoftICE, which was a kernel mode debugger, and another product called Bounce Checker.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, I was at Numega, and they really couldn't figure out what to do with me. They were hoping to figure out the third big product idea and wanted people ready to go to work on it. So I had some free time on my hands, and Windows NT had caught my imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to research, try to figure out how Windows NT worked, what it was all about, and started writing tools for it that both helped me learn about the way that it works, as well as in the process of writing them, I'd learn more about the way the system works. The first tool I actually wrote was Control-to-Cap. Having worked on Unix systems when I was in college and grad school, I was used to control keeping where the caps lock key is on PC keyboards, and I felt very uncomfortable on PC keyboards. So this Control-to-Cap kernel mode driver would flip the keystrokes as they came in.
Mm-hmm.
So that was where my introduction into the I/O system and way to do file I/O filtering. And then I'd done some academic research on adding mechanisms to operating systems through system call hooking.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at the way Windows did system call, its system calls from user mode to kernel mode, and knew that there was this database, configuration database called the registry, and realized that if I hooked system calls, I could write a tool that would show you the accesses to that database, and that became Regmon.
Okay.
And then...
And Regmon basically monitors the settings and then gives you a different spec?
Actually, it just monitors them in, as live operations. So it just shows you a scrolling list of the operations there, a process that's making the operation, the path to the operation, the data that comes back, and the result of the operation.
Mm-hmm.
And also at the same time, Control2Cap, again, had introduced me to I/O filtering, and I realized that if I wrote a filter driver for the file system, NTFS and FAT, that I'd also be able to write a similar tool for watching file system activity, and that became FileMon. And those two tools were the first Windows NT tools. We also, it was Bryce Cogswell and I that worked together on these. We ported them to Windows 9X, so we actually had two versions of those tools, one for Windows 9X and one for NT. And
so,
go ahead.
I was going to say that that is literally doing a hook into the events of the registry changing, so it's not a looking at it and then going back and comparing after the fact.
Right, right. It's not a post-processing, differencing kind of thing. It's a live trace of the activity on the system. Those two tools, a lot of people probably know if you've been using SysInternals tools.
Mm-hmm.
Right after we joined Microsoft, we released Process Monitor, which is a much more powerful version of those tools,
right,
combined with more functionality and different ways to look at the trace data.
So with the Process Monitor, which kind of gives you the views and all the different threads and what's happening, how does that – I know that in Windows 7 they introduced a resource monitor that provides some charts and graphs and a little bit of drill down. Is there some collaboration going on there?
Yeah, absolutely. When during the Windows 7 time frame, while we were figuring out what to do, I met with – I was working with the fundamentals team, the team that is responsible for those inbox tools like Task Manager and the Resource Monitor. And talking we basically talked about what features from the SysInternals tools, Process Explorer and Process Monitor, were worth or we should consider putting in the product itself. And we always started at the point, why don't we just take Process Monitor or Process Explorer and put that in the box?
Mm-hmm.
And I still get asked that question, why aren't these things just in the box? And there's a number of reasons for why we didn't think it made sense to put them in the box. The first is that they're tools that have evolved over 10 years. And if you look at the coding, the source code to them, you can see the effects of 10 years of organically growing.
Mm-hmm.
And the maturation of my development skills over that time. The tools were not written with originally with security in mind. They were written with internationalization in mind, things that any Microsoft product would have to implement and take very seriously. So it would be a significant amount of work making them in-box product ready.
Making it so that, because I think that if, you know, where a lot of developers come from is we build software for a particular audience.
Yeah.
In a particular language, in a particular way, and we don't think necessarily about, gosh, someone might buy this from, you know, that doesn't speak, you know, English or whatever. And that's got to be a learning process, being able to go back to support that. Because you've been building products for quite a time.
Yeah, and the philosophy we had with WinTernal software was different, where we did make sure that all our software was ready to be internationalized. We did internationalize some of our software, first for the Japanese market, the WinTernal software. But when you're writing free software, which is software that I'm doing for fun that is going to that I think other people find useful, you cut corners. Otherwise, it just wouldn't be, you know, you wouldn't be able to get out the cool stuff in time if you're spending all your time getting the making sure the thing's internationalizable and the other kind of mundane chores that really aren't going to do much to make the product more accessible. And certainly I felt the value was adding features to the products and writing new tools rather than spending my time on those kinds of things. But another reason why it doesn't really make sense to put the tools in the product is if you look at the features in a tool like Process Explorer,
mm-hmm.
90% of the features in there are beyond the understanding of even the power users that are out there using the product. Really, there's large swaths of functionality there that very few people ever come across and that would ever find useful, really targeted at really hardcore developers and support engineers at Microsoft and other companies.
So what you're going to say is that my mom might not use all those tools?
Right, and you probably wouldn't either. You probably, if you've used Process Explorer, you probably only scratch the surface of the things that it can do just because the way that you use it hasn't led you into those other areas where you don't need to know what the I/O priorities of different threads are, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So we figured that, you know, when you put something in the product, especially if it's arcane and out of reach, you've got to document exactly what is going on there, and the effort that it requires to productize something, you've got to weigh against the utility that it's going to provide to the overall audience. Like if we're really just addressing tens of thousands of users out of the close to a billion Windows installed base,
mm-hmm.
is it really worth putting it in the product? And when you consider the fact that most of the people that do find that kind of functionality useful and interesting already know about sysinternals and the tools, and they can go to sysinternals and get the updates from there that iterate very quickly with new features, publishing on sysinternals is certainly a lot more agile than
right. Really
getting something from a Windows release every 3 years.
Well, I suppose it's sort of like you got to be surprised by the tools that people really, really find useful. Like Zoomit is one that I always get asked on whenever I do a presentation. How do you draw on the screen like that?
Yeah, Zoomit is a tool that Dave Solomon and I had been teaching classes since the late 90s, from even earlier. And he'd introduced me to this zooming tool that had come with a mouse at one point, or I believe it was a mouse that he'd gotten. It was some hardware company that provided the software that would let you do zooming, but it was so cumbersome and clunky.
Mm-hmm.
It was just really a frustrating experience using it, and I decided at one point, I think this was 2005, all right, enough is enough. I'm just going to write my own zooming tool that does everything exactly the way that I want it to, that's very lightweight, that makes it very intuitive to use so that you don't even have to think about using it while you're presenting,
mm-hmm.
and thus was born Zoomit.
So that sort of was the genesis. What's interesting is that I do a lot of talking in front of crowds, and it seems like you keep adding features that I would have added. So it's like you're inside of my head.
That's great.
I love that. Hey, we do have some questions in the queue, and I've got John in Seattle who's got a question here. John, are you there?
Yeah. I wanted to see if this year, if you'll be at TechEd.
Yep, I'm going to be at TechEd. I've been at actually every TechEd U.S. and Europe since 2001, so no difference this year. Be at TechEd New Orleans the beginning of June. I'm giving 4 sessions there. Case of the Unexplained, which is a talk that I've been giving for the last 4 or 5 TechEds. Every Case of the Unexplained, though, is filled with totally different cases that I pull from a massive collection of troubleshooting cases that I've come up with on my own and also had sent to me by people.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone is unique, shows different techniques and stories, troubleshooting examples.
Are those available for download after the fact? I mean, can you find them on like YouTubes and places like that?
TechEd does record a bunch of sessions, and I do have, I think, 3 or 4 Case of Unexplained sessions that you can go watch on demand on. If you go to sysinternals and go to Mark's webcast link on the left menu, you
mm-hmm.
can go find links to previous TechEd Case of the Unexplained, as well as talks on Process Monitor as well.
Because the Case of the Unexplained, the first time I saw you deliver a session like that, it's like you go through 4 or 5 or 6 different scenarios and which tool you use to identify what was going on.
Yeah.
And I watched that, and I went home and tried to do it, and I about killed my machine. So I think it takes a little bit more knowledge of the tools than what I've been able to glean so far.
Well, but it's a really good way to kind of think about using some powerful tools to do that kind of analysis too. So it's kind of a best practices. So what other sessions are you doing at TechEd?
Windows 7 and Server 2008 are two kernel changes. That's a fun talk that goes beneath the hood of the latest releases and talks about the features and some of the philosophies that we had as we came up with the features. The third talk is called Pushing the Limits of Windows, and that's a talk that was born from a series of blog posts that I'd posted called Pushing the Limits, and there's like six or seven of them that I've put up that cover different types of resources, starting with physical memory, then virtual memory, then page pool and on-page pool, GDI and user objects, discussing the limits of those resources across different versions of Windows, from XP up to Server 2008 R2. How do you measure the resource usage of those types of resources? It describes how the system behaves when those resources are exhausted and how to detect exhaustion. So I've written a tool called Test Limit that actually will exercise those various resources and try to exhaust them so that you can see the way Windows behaves. And that the presentation is essentially a summary of those blog posts. And then the final session is a first time I'm delivering this session. It's something that me and Mark Manassi have been talking about doing for a long time, which is giving a session on giving technical talks. So we're doing that the last day of the conference, me and Mark Manassi together giving that kind of talk. I think that'll be a lot of fun. Me and Mark have a great rapport, I think.
Yeah, that'll be excellent. I'm really looking forward to that, too. Do we have any other questions in the queue yet, Mike?
Yeah, we do. We've got Alex in Minneapolis. Alex, are you there?
Yes.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Not too bad.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question for Mark Rusinovich. There is an awful lot of very useful tools there on sysinternals, and one that used to be very popular was Rootkit Revealer. I understand from some forums that it is no longer maintained. At the same time, the security becomes more and more important. I wonder if you would consider updating it for Windows 7.
So that's a really good question, and something that I'd need to address at some point on the sysinternal site. The reason that we haven't updated it is we saw this even before we joined Microsoft with Rootkit Revealer, is the cat and mouse game that you end up playing with the Rootkit authors. It becomes very difficult for somebody writing a tool like this that is public and widely available to win that game for any period of time. What we saw, for example, was Hacker Defender, one of the very high-profile rootkits back when Rootkit Revealer came out. What Holy Father, the author of, he called himself the author of Hacker Defender, did when Rootkit Revealer came out was to release a version of Hacker Defender that didn't hide from Rootkit Revealer. So Rootkit Revealer looks for hidden things, and when Hacker Defender saw Rootkit Revealer scanning for it, it would uncloak the things that was hiding otherwise, and so Rootkit Revealer wouldn't detect it. And when we, Bryce and I sat down, went through the mental exercise, okay, what if we're the bad guys? How do we attack Rootkit Revealer? The list of ways that you can go defeat a product like that is endless and impossible to defend against.
Right.
So we realized that we could stay ahead of the game maybe for a short period of time, but what one of the things that we anticipated and that we've really seen is that rootkit authors have gotten much more sophisticated. The kinds of rootkits that we're seeing these days are tremendously sophisticated compared to what we were seeing out in the wild, like Hacker Defender,
right,
back then. So it really doesn't make sense to us to do this. At the same time, if you look at all the commercial software companies, McAfee, Symantec, Kaspersky, they all have rootkit detection technologies in their software now, and they've got obviously staffs of programmers that are focused on that full time. So Rootkit Revealer, we think, served its purpose. It accomplished its mission. It helped raise awareness of rootkits and help people detect the early variants of rootkits that were popular at the time it came out. But I think it's really run its course, and all it really does now is keep rootkit developers from falling back onto the lazy primitive types of rootkits that Rootkit Revealer would be able to detect.
Thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks, Alex.
Thanks, Alex. You know, just when you're talking about how the rootkits have evolved and how, you know, it's gotten more sophisticated and getting smarter, technology just in general has been speeding up, getting faster. You know, we went from having 8K of memory to having 16 gig on a micro SD card.
Yeah, it's been pretty flabbergasting, the kind of changes. And we were just talking about the Apple II, which ran at, I think, 25 megahertz and 8-bit processor and 64K of RAM. And compare that with what you've got in, on your laptop computers these days, or even your cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And a cell phone today is equivalent of a circa 2002, 2003 PC.
Well, I've got a selfish question for you. And that is, when you're looking at building out a presentation or a developer machine, you know, it used to be you'd look at just adding memory because it would be memory bound, and then it could be disk bound because of spindle speed. With the with all the virtualization and everything else that's going on, when you're putting together a machine that you want to get the top performance out of, what are the top three things you look at, and that you consider saying, hey, this would be probably make the biggest impact?
So when it comes to a presentation machine, you know, even running with virtual machines, pretty much any reasonable mid to high end laptop will do the job.
Mm-hmm.
The system that I currently have has an SSD and a decent video card in it, video chip processor in it. Where I spend more time worrying about what components to get is when I build out my gaming system for home.
Ooh.
And that's where I pretty much go and find top of the line components.
The video.
So video card, SSD, RAM, fast RAM, top of the line CPU core that I can overclock.
Mm-hmm. Well, boot from VHD has made it easier to go out and build different scenarios on machines. But still, it comes back to, you know, I've got the SSD on my presentation machine now, and it's got the 160 gig of RAM, essentially, because it's
mm-hmm.
that fast. You know, if you go out and look at the disk queue length, it's like it's gone down to almost nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where are these machines getting slowed down? Is it just too many conflicting different processes? I mean, it seems like the CPU is literally going to become where you need to have the multi-core and be smart about parallel and task management and the rest of it looking forward.
Really, it's for the most part, it's total amount of I/O. Even though the SSD queue length is small, it still has a bounded throughput,
mm-hmm.
And writes are going to be relatively expensive on an SSD, especially random writes. So there's just no way to get rid of that. That has finite cost, and I'm sure if you look at those situations where the system appears to be running slowly or software appears to be running slowly, it's almost always going to be I/O bound.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's going to be
or waiting on the network. That's another thing that you see a lot these days.
The network?
Yeah.
I put my father-in-law into DSL recently, and so that but he still runs into, hey, the machine's running slowly. What do you do? And then I tell him about your session that you're going to be doing at Tech Ed on the case of the unexplained.
Yeah.
All right, Mark. Well, we are just about out of time. Any call to action, anything that you want to leave people with?
Just stay tuned to SysInternals. We've got a new tool coming out this week called RAM Map, which is a tool that will show you exactly what's in RAM from a number of different perspectives.
Is it graphical?
It's got a couple of graphical views.
Oh, cool.
But it was one of those tools that we saw that there's support for getting this kind of information out of Vista and Hire. And just like a bunch of the other SysInternals tools, we just said, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we could display that information? Maybe that might be a useful tool. In any case, it would just be fascinating to be able to look and see and answer the question, what is consuming RAM? What's sitting in RAM? What files are in RAM? What pieces of files? Those are kinds of questions that we really couldn't answer before. And so just as a teaching learning tool for the Windows Internals book and seminars, it would be useful. But
all right.
So that's coming out this week.
Well, 3 weeks from today, you'll be at TechEd, so people can come and see your sessions. I'll be at TechEd along with Kevin, and I'm going to be doing some interviews and talking to people about Windows 7. So if you've got any Windows 7 applications that you've lit up and they look pretty cool, I'd love to talk to you. But that is what we've got for this week. So I want to thank everyone for joining us. If you wanted to listen to the other webcasts that are the radio shows that are part of this, you can get to them by going out to msdnradio.com and then clicking on the RSS feed. There's a tiny URL shortcut to get to the series as well, tinyurl.com/msdnradio. We do have a quick survey that we'll be putting up so that if you have any questions or have comments on how we can improve the show, we're always looking to hear from you. But with that, that's what we've got for this week. I'm Mike Benkovich, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. So that's it for this Monday. Go to msdnradio.com and click the registration link if you want to participate in the next show. Until then, happy coding.